not just features of minor white. And various times that I have known him. And so, as this little article starts out, my mother saw the ad in the paper for the class in beginning photography that was being taught by Minor White on a Monday night or whatever.
What paper was this?
That would be the Le Grand Evening Observer.
Oh, yes.
At that time.
Uh-huh.
And so she said, as I said, that's a strange first name. Let's go take his class. Because I had been encouraged by and learned much of my beginning photography from my mother, who had learned it in turn from her father, who worked with glass negatives, glass plates. And so...
Was he a professional photographer? Your father?
No, among other things, he was a member of Oregon legislature under the Populist Party.
Ah.
And he was high up in the Grange and thrust of the Grange. And
what was his name?
Charles D., as in dog, Huffman. H-U-F-F-M-A-N.
And was he from Elgin?
No, he was from Le Grand, too. Ah. I think he was basically from the Willamette Valley. Because my grandmother went down to the Willamette Valley to work as a domestic and worked in his home when his first wife passed away and wound up getting married to him. Then they came back here to the Le Grand area and took up farming over in... Moore Park, which is across the river, and then they came back here to Cove Avenue and expanded on the homestead. Now, my mother's people were McAllisters, of the McAllister Road lineage down there, and so until my father passed away in 93, the particular piece of property, which had diminished down to 7.5 acres by that time, was still part of the original homestead. But anyway, Mother had gotten me interested. She ran around with a group of perhaps 10 young people, and photography was the nucleus of their activities. They would go out on a weekend and find some piece of road grading machinery, climb all over it, get the picture taken. I have inherited her negatives, and there are pictures of this same gang up on the roof of a house. Everybody get up on the roof of the house. Somebody's on top of a windmill tower hanging on like this.
Was this photography mostly for fun, or do you think
absolutely.
They were serious about it?
Oh, no, it was just for fun. It was just something that they did, whatever, and so she got me interested. She had a camera, a folding camera, but by the time I came along even, the film was not available in that size, so she condescended to a box camera, and so she had a small box camera for me. And basically, we never went any place without the camera. And so she got me interested, and so she cleared off a little spot in the cellar where I could make contact prints. And she took me to Imbler to visit with Garth Westenskoe. Garth Westenskoe was about a year older than I. And so Mom visited with Mrs. Westenskoe while Garth and I went out to his little public corner, and he showed me the process of making contact prints. And so
you were a teenager then?
I was hooked. No, I was 11.
Oh.
That's 2 years prior to
Yes, me. It is.
Yes, yes. And anyway, from then on, I increased in my camera capacities, so I finally bought, oh man, for $6.75, I bought a Jiffy 620. Now that was nothing more basically than a folding box camera. The lens would focus 5 to 10 feet or beyond 10 feet.
Infinity, they called it.
Yes, yes. And they had diaphragm stops with three little holes in the tab that you pulled out. Well, I never changed that. You know, don't worry about that. Shutter speeds, I, instantaneous, T for time. You had those options. Mm-hmm. And so then after I got ready to get into college over here, I increased that to another same size film, but it would focus from 4 feet to 6 feet to 10 feet. I mean, you had a little bit of gradation in the focus, and the 5-speed shutters, tenths to a 200th. Oh man. And then just before we met Minor, I acquired this miniature speed graphic, which would do all sorts of things. It was still 2.25 by 3.25, but I had that then when Mr. White asked, are there any classy jobs? Remember in the introduction to that first class, introductions around, and then he says, what kind of a camera do you use? And so here's box camera and box camera and box camera. Somebody has a folding roll film. And so he was getting not particularly encouraged, you know. So he says, are there any classy jobs? And I proudly announced that I had this miniature speed graphic with a 3.5 Zeiss Tesser. Do you like it? I was shocked. How could anybody not like such a camera, you know? But anyway, we developed into a friendship that lasted, and he didn't have a car, and I had access to ours, and on weekends, if he was free, we'd go off on some photo expedition, usually out to High Valley.
Take me back, if you would, to the time when you first saw him and where.
Oh, we first met him in number 10 Depot, which is the Veterans of Foreign War building now. But that was a building that was rented by the federal government, WPA Art Center type thing. And he had photography. Somebody else was doing silk screen. Somebody else was doing watercolor, all sorts of art activities financed by the federal government. And so there was a dark room in the basement of that building.
Was that 1934?
No, that would be 40. But he came in 1940, mm-hmm. And I left September 16th of 1940. So we only really had that summer together. But we went one time up to Ice Lake, and that's when this picture was taken. You notice it's one of his, mm-hmm. at the time. And
do you remember the conversation?
Oh yeah, he was tickled to death. He laughed at this little tiny rock that was holding up that
big
one.
Yes.
And I can remember comments that he was making about that.
Was he particular about the way the clouds looked and the way the light fell on the rock?
No. You're there, and that's the light that's there, and we're not going to be here all afternoon. We got to start hiking back.
So he took it the way it was.
You take it the way it was and do the best you can with it.
Did he offer any comments about the composition or whether he was pleased that it has the elements that it does?
Not that I remember. Mm-hmm. Not that I remember.
I guess I'm just fishing for whether or not you sensed at that time that he was or wanted to be an artist photographer.
No, I didn't get that feeling from him.
Did you have any idea what it meant to be an artist photographer at that time?
Well, yeah, I think so, because I had taken some pictures that I thought were good enough in a small enlargement to go on the wall. And
what qualities at that time did you think comprised an artistic photograph?
Oh, the old rules of composition that once you get into it, you learn to ignore, of placing the primary subject in the third corners, whatever they are, and if you want texture, get the sun coming from the side so it'll cast little shadows. Never shoot into the sun, you know, all of this stuff like that, and so on. But
you were following those rules at that point, or trying to?
Trying to, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You kind of realize that you're not going to get back to this place.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to take what's there at that time, whatever the light conditions may be, and so on.
At that point, had you been primarily photographing natural objects rather than people or buildings?
I had a lot of people, that, you know, just friends, kids in high school, and things that would go into anybody's ordinary photo album, you know, mm-hmm. pictures of people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not quite like the early movies when somebody would be standing by the car and they would say, well, this is movies, do something, and they would wave, you know. It wasn't quite that bad, but I did carry this second camera basically every day that I went to college. And so I have maybe a couple of hundred negatives that I took while I was going to school. And those would be people, other students, in classrooms, some sports activities.
I have a feeling, though, that maybe at that stage, quite early in your life, photography for you was becoming more of just a thing to do for fun than something that was for a more serious purpose.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It was
fun. Were you
fun.
Recording history? Is that one of the purposes you might have sensed?
Probably not. I was just, here's a picture of a guy, you know, and I want to get a picture of him like that. He's on a bicycle. Okay, whatever. And no, it wasn't until after after I got into service, I guess, and that was after 1940, after I'd had this time with Minor, and then overseas we were able to have cameras and take pictures, and I began to try to get some nice arty things, recording palm trees and sunsets and things that could have some fine art value, whatever.
Were you also thinking at that point of possibly becoming a professional photographer?
Oh, yes, yes.
Are you living that way?
I was working kind of in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking, you know, prior to this time, Sears Roebuck, Montgomery Ward catalogs used drawings. And, you know, they're going to be using photographs. And I'm going to get me a job as a photographer to photograph fashion. Of course, that was just a couple of years of wistful thinking, because you begin to realize that, hey, that isn't really the thrust that you want to go to. But that was one thought. And then when I did get home from the service and out, I applied to probably four different art schools, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, and they were all full, because I got discharged from the service in the third group of returnees, whatever, and the first two had filled the schools, so there was not a space for me, even though I submitted a portfolio to the California School of Fine Arts, and Minor wrote back that he was awfully sorry, but that the class had filled at number 20 and I was 28. Something like that, and that Ansel was not impressed enough with what I had sent in to move me ahead or anything like that. And then in early September, a couple of 3 weeks after the school classes had started, I get this telegram from him, and it says, have opening, can you make it?
Is this 1945?
This was 46. Because I got out in 47, yeah, 46, fall of 46. Well, I got out of the service in September 45, and I worked in Tacoma in a photo studio for a number of months. But then we get down and get under Ansel's teaching, and Miner taught a secondary class. It was still one of the options, and you took it. There were just two teachers. But Miner's thrust was that some part of you must show through in the photograph.
And did he say that he could tell whether it did or not?
I don't know that he ever did that, but
I'd be going out on a limb, wouldn't it?
It sure would. It sure would. But we boys, and there were some girls in the class too, but we boys got to thinking, you know, whether we show through in that photograph isn't going to sell a photograph to a client that wants a picture of an exploded pump for an exploded illustration in a catalog.
Mm-hmm.
That whether you come through in that pump or not isn't going to make a bit of difference. And so we kind of poo-pooed the idea, but he had us reading a number of books.
Did you kind of have an ambivalent attitude toward him at that point? Maybe you thought he had highfalutin ideas that didn't have much practical application?
We were pretty well convinced that Miner would teach you to play with it if you had some other source of income,
uh-huh.
where Ansel Adams would teach you to make a living at it. And that was totally the difference. And
when Adams didn't say there had to be some part of you showing through the photograph?
No, he didn't. He did not say that. But
he knew that was bullshit, didn't he?
He did, yeah. Yeah, he and Miner exchanged a lot of letters, but none of them really convinced Ansel to change his thrust.
Uh-huh.
But, I don't know. There were a number of books that he recommended that we read that had to do with if you're an actor, how you must...
An actor prepares.
Prepare, yes. And be, mm-hmm. be the character, mm-hmm. whatever. So you're to be whatever. And then...
As I read in this photography magazine article, journal, about his... theories, and also in this article, it did strike me that he was so way up in the clouds in these theories, and that probably the theories didn't make a great deal of sense, but somehow, apparently, they made him seem to other people as though he knew what he was talking about, or that he had something important to say.
I think you're absolutely right. I think so.
But if you had to summarize any of his theories in a few words, you probably couldn't do it.
I couldn't, no. Because Ansel taught you quality, how to make prints that had real dynamic print quality, how to get the negatives developed. But Miner, that was a minor portion,
yeah.
of his teaching. His teaching was some of you has to come through with it.
However, several of his photographs, from what I know, like the iron front buildings in,
yes,
Portland,
in Portland,
that he would take at 7 o'clock in the morning when there was no one there, would you say that they have some of the qualities that Ansel Adams would have admired?
Oh, I'm sure they do.
So,
oh yeah,
theory,
oh, no,
he knew how to use a camera, right?
Yeah, he wasn't totally out of it as far as the mechanics were concerned. But he gave me a book one time. And in it he wrote, in hopes of improving your lousy technique.
Yeah. He could be sarcastic, couldn't he?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Here is another article in...
Oh, yes.
I don't know.
Supplement to the Observer.
Mm-hmm. And so there's some more of the same stuff, and I think it's by Dick...
Dick Mason.
Yeah.
Right. May 18th, 1995.
And so here's the same picture. Then.
Yeah, cropped.
Yeah, yes. Who'd they crop out?
be irrelevant.
Yeah, be irrelevant.
We skipped ahead several years here from the time he was in Le Grand.
Oh, yes.
Could we go back to the time when you met him in the studio and how you interacted?
Oh, yeah. He liked me. He thought I could even be worked into being an assistant to him, helping along. And
Do you think he thought you were serious about photography?
I think, oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
He says, you may not ever be an artist, but you're going to be a damn good photographer.
I can live with that, huh?
Yeah, but yeah, I could live. And so we would go out on these jaunts, field trips, whatever. This picture that he took of me by the haystack, you know, just sitting there, wherever it is, was on one of those times. And we'd go out and we'd be photographing a while, and then we'd get tired and we'd go sit in the shade of some apple tree out in the field and just sit there and talk.
Were you almost the same age?
He was born in 1908, so he was 12 years older than I was. But my mother liked him, and once in a while she'd go with us on one of these jaunts, but most of the time she stayed home, and we would end the day by coming by the house, and he'd have supper with us, and he called her Ma. Ma Hill, whatever, and so I have.
Was she living in Elgin then?
Yes.
And so you'd have to drive out there each day?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. So here are many letters mm-hmm. that are addressed to my mother, even from overseas where they've been passed by the censor,
uh-huh.
which he has sent home stuff. And he would send her Christmas cards. I've got some Christmas cards that he made here. And then. Here's some letters from Peter Bunnell, who is the director of the Art Museum, Art Institute there at Princeton University, where the Minor White Archives are, mm-hmm. and so on. But
when you were in this, I guess it was a class in the number 10 Depot Street studio or classroom. What kinds of critiques or comments was he giving you about your photographs?
He assigned one subject one time, and I've forgotten how the terminology was, but my mother took an old floor lamp and took the shade off of it and whatever, and it has these three arms that come out to hold three lights. She took it out in the backyard and she hung a bunch of exploded or at least shot flash bulbs when they used to be in the shape of a light bulb.
Mm-hmm.
She hung about five or six of those just hanging down from it. And whatever it was about it, it tickled him, and he laughed and laughed and laughed about that. And somewhere in some album. I ran across that picture the other day within the last couple of months. But
sounds as though he might have had an eye for the impractical or
for
the surprising.
So, something that surprised him, and
mm-hmm.
he was willing. But shortly after I got into the Army, well, maybe almost a year, I still get letters from him, and we had tried on several occasions to meet in Portland. He would go down to Portland for something, and he wondered if I could come down from Fort Lewis. And one time, I did make it, and I got a room in the YMCA, and it was in the YMCA that he was involved with the Oregon Camera Club, which met there and mm-hmm. worked there. And one time, there was a display of pictures, and he says, "Well, pick out the best one." And so there were 11 by 14s and 8 by 10s, and I picked out a small 5 by 7 print by Lucia Hammer. He says, "You know, you might make an artist yet." I can't remember what the subject was. I just remember the girl's name, because somewhere in some of the later stuff, I don't think it's in this one, but the name Lucia Hammer showed up again. what if she had not gotten married, or before she did, whatever, I don't know.
Was he presenting himself to you as being himself, an artist in photography?
Oh, I think so, yes.
Did he ever use that term about himself?
No, not about himself, but that was the thrust of what we did. We should be artists, and what's in us deep down should come through in some way into the photographs that we take.
So you started saying that early on.
Oh, yes.
So you think he really believed it then?
Yeah, I think he did.
Did you ever say, oh, come on, Miner, get off it, will you?
I should have.
Yes.
I should have, but I don't remember that I ever did. But anyway, we kept in contact, and then he, to his great annoyance, got drafted. And so he wound up also in the South Pacific, and that's where I had the opportunity to meet him.
Yes.
I found out where he was, and we got together.
He lost a lot of hair by then, hadn't he?
Oh.
Yeah.
I enjoy taking pictures of the top of his head.
Yes.
We went down, well, after we got out, and I got to got down to the California School of Fine Arts and got started. The Pepsi-Cola company wanted to put out a brochure promoting their scholarship fund. And so they gave Miner a list of situations that they wanted illustrated. And they would pay some reasonable pittance for the work. And so Miner picked about six of us to serve and do those pictures. They furnished a script and they furnished a paid model, and we took him from San Francisco down to Stanford to get onto campus. We took him to a post office and just carried the life of it all the way through. And so finally the book got put together, and I can remember one thing in there where Miner was telling us about shooting with flash, and Dick Muffley came over to me and he says, that guy hasn't popped off many flash bulbs. Because what he was theorizing on flash just didn't work particularly. But there's one picture in there that shows a thumb, something handling. No, it was just one or two back. Anyway, it's my thumb.
Oh. Accidental.
I'm holding it. Yeah, here's this picture. This is supposedly
John Norman,
mm-hmm. after he had become a successful whatever it is. But yeah, this one is outstanding. Look at that, the way this gal is showing the grades. You know? Mm-hmm. But this is the model that they put. But someplace in there, I'm holding out here. Mm-hmm. There's my thumb. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we worked on that, and that served as a class project. And I don't know, we got $25 a piece or something like that, which helped buy some more film. But I got a hold of three of those magazines, and I sent one of them back to Peter Burnell in the Stanford University, and he was grateful for it. Anyway, then when we found out that Miner was going to be the surviving teacher, and that Ansel had only agreed to establish the course and teach the first year, then there's about six of us that bailed out because we needed to get into industry and get to working. We had learned basically zone system of controls and so forth.
Tell me a little more about that.
Well, it's a controlled measurement of light and so forth, whereby you can keep the contrast range within the film's ability to hold it. So if something is way out and it would be way overexposed, you can determine how much you have to overexpose and then short develop to reduce the contrast. Or if you've got something that's a side of a shingled wall and maybe just a plant coming up across it, where the contrast from the brightest to the darkest is very low, then you can underexpose and long develop to spread it out. So you can get the negatives into more printable ranges.
Do you determine this just by inspection, or do you use a meter?
Oh, you use a meter and... own equipment, because shutters vary. Some of them are too slow, tired. You mean you want me to go for a hundredth of a second? How about 50th? You know, shutters will say that.
Is the term zone system still in use?
Oh, indeed. Indeed it is. And even some of the new magazines that I've gotten within the last couple of months, there will be some article in which somebody refers to using a zone system.
And do you know who developed it first?
Well, Ansel is the one that, he's the one that calibrated the thing so that you know how much you have to underexpose. And we have these charts that he made up into booklets so that you have the range from 1 to 10, because you go 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128. You know, it's doubling each time, and the 10 zones is about the maximum that you can hold from solid black to opaque white. And so I went out looking for a job, and there was a Jewish photographer in town in San Francisco, and I went to apply to him, and I told him that I had had this much experience and was aware of the zone system. He said, "Ha! We don't have time for that garbage. We got to get the shot made and go." And he was willing to take me on a on-the-job training, which means that I get basically no salary or whatever, but I'm learning from him, who says, "We don't have time for that garbage." And then I applied to the Southern Pacific Railroad. They have a photo department, and they said, "Well, we'd love to have you. Your background is great, but until somebody dies, there's not going to be an opening, because nobody that's on staff wants to leave this department. It's too juicy a job." So I finally accepted the job in Oakland with a guy who had delusions of grandeur. This is 1947, and aircraft travel was still novel. See, 47, you know, the DC-3s, whatever. So he rented a room at the Oakland airport and made it into a dark room. And he wanted somebody to be out there on the field when people got off of planes, to take a picture of them, give them a card, and say, "You have had a picture taken as you deplaned, and cash with order, we'll send you one for $5. I don't know. Anyway, you'd have to pre-number the film, because you're using 4x5 individual sheets of film. Pre-number them and have a number that match that on the card, and you had to be sure. And he did not sell one picture, and so forth. And so finally he closed that down and brought me into his studio in downtown Oakland, and I was doing all of the darkroom work. And I knew that there wasn't enough work going to that plant to keep both of us. So I was not surprised when one day, on a Wednesday, he called me in and he said, "I've been borrowing money from my wife, because she was working as a secretary somewhere, for the last 2 weeks to pay your salary." He said, "I can pay you through Friday." He said, "I'm going to have to just forget it, you know." So So he sent me out looking, and I went to the Bureau of Employment, and they had two openings. One at the Payless Fish Market, cleaning fish. Or if I could speak Portuguese, I could be up on the sales counter and make 10 cents an hour more. Or the other one was at Nordstrom Valve Company for an industrial blueprint reader that could read a blueprint and determine the specifications for the valves that were shown, whether it's a hospital, a plumbing job, or something like that. And of course, I didn't qualify for that. And so then he says, well, why don't you go out and check with the grocery stores? Well, I had worked in a grocery store in Elgin, and there was nothing that was further from my interest than working in a grocery store. But you're getting to the point where you have a home that has monthly payments, and you have one son. And so I went out and I looked at three different grocery stores, and one of them was hiring in Richmond, and we lived in San Lorenzo, which is the extreme other side of the city. And Safeway wasn't hiring, Hagstrom's wasn't hiring, Purity stores weren't hiring, and so they said, well, did you try Lucky Stores? And I said, well, I thought I did, but apparently I wrote down the wrong address, that there was nothing there. And so this salesman that was in there, another office occupant of this trade building, he said, well, who did you see at Lucky's? And I said, I didn't find it. And he said, ah, let me pave the way for you. So he gets on the phone and he calls the office manager at Lucky Stores. And he talks for about 5 minutes, telling him that these Atlas adding machines that they have ordered, two of them I suppose, were going to get there on time. They were going to do everything that they expected of them. They were going to be absolutely trouble-free. And by the way, I have a favor I'd like to ask. I have a young man here that would like to learn the grocery business. So anyway, he sends me down to meet the office manager. And I went down to the and met the office manager, and the fellow says, well, we don't have anything at the stores, but he says, we do have a job running a printing press. He says, the man that's running it has given us his notice that he's quitting. I don't want you to go back and talk to him. He'll give you some wrong ideas. I don't want you to see the equipment. Just come back. But he did give me the name of the distributor and the serviceman that had set up this thing. And so I went down to a corner phone booth and called San Francisco, and they told me that they were surprised that he was leaving. They were also not able to supply anybody that already knew how to run it, because the office manager said that if we find somebody who knows how to run it, we'll take the line of least resistance, of course. And so I talked for about half an hour, and the fellow says, well, I think you can handle this. And so then I went back the next day and checked in with the office manager at Lucky's, and so they sent me on company time over to San Francisco for 3 days to work on the demonstrator press and learn how to run the thing, and then came back and I got the job. I'm back here running this press, and the serviceman came in every day that week to see how I was getting along.
These were to produce the inserts that they used for advertising?
No, these are producing forms.
Oh.
Forms. And because they'd been farming them out. And they had an order book, a catalog type of thing that was specially built, and we ran that off. And that was the prime job of it, but we expanded it at every opportunity. Because my theory was, the more that we are self-contained and the more that we can do it ourselves, the more secure our jobs are going to be.
And so all the way through for 38 and a half years there, I worked on that theory, and we expanded it to where it was quite a tuning shop. Anyway, so finally then, it came time to sign up for a union. It was office workers, which is fine, or it was warehousemen, or it was the truck drivers, and so forth. And so I put in this application to office workers as a printing pressman. And in those days, the unions were not quite so greedy, and so they sent back a notice that they don't have a category of printing pressmen, so they had referred my application to the pressmen's union. And so in the next day or two, the organizer for the pressmen's union came down to talk to me. And I thought, oh man, this is the end of it, because they're not going to want one more union represented that has just one man in it. And so the then office manager came back with the man to talk to me, and I was dragging my feet a little bit, and he said, well, if you really don't want to join the pressmen's union, you can wash windows for Lucky Sword if you want to, and we'll send somebody down to the union hall to run this press. And so the office manager then said, well, we're not bothered by the fact that there might be one more union represented. And so then I was willing to safely join. I was not a great union enthusiast, never have been particularly, but the first meeting that I went to, where you're sworn in, where you stand up and vow never to stand by and see a brother wrong, all that stuff, that was the night that they started to organize the need for a pension plan. So I got in on the ground floor of that, like that, which had been most helpful. But anyway, I kept in touch with Minor and whatever, and a number of these letters that are censored were written to my mother, and in there I got Christmas cards that he made and sent to her, and so forth. And so, but when we got down to San Francisco, we were pulling a 24-foot house trailer with a little six-cylinder Dodge. Anyway, we got there, we made it, and went on through and went down towards Daly City to an auto court where we could park a trailer. And they had a waiting list of about 14 names ahead of me. And Martha was in the trailer, parked parallel along the Mission Boulevard there in Daly City. And I'm gone, and I'm not coming back, and I don't come back, and I don't come back. But in that interval of about 45 minutes, I had talked my way from 14th down to 2nd. And they said, there'll be an opening for you in about 8 days. There are two people that are leaving in a week court. In the auto court place. So then I called Minor, and he says, well, come on up, and you can park in front of Ansel's house. Now, Ansel Adams' folks lived next door, and they're out in the Sunset District in San Francisco, basically right near the south end of the Golden Gate Bridge. And Ansel had moved in with his folks. His wife was still in Yosemite operating Best Studio, which was a retail outlet up there. And so Miner had taken over the house, and he had four other students that were living there. And Miner says, you can park the trailer in front of the house, but you can't live in it. The city won't allow that. But you can sleep on a Davenport in the front room for these 7 days, 8 days, whatever it was. And by the way, would Martha cook for the group? We had just been through two flat tires and all day long driving with a 6-week-old baby, pulling a trailer that is towed by a totally underpowered unit. She was totally exhausted, but I don't know. she didn't have any idea what food stuffs were available. He said the gang will be home in about half an hour, and we'll eat in about an hour. It's about 6 o'clock, they'd be home by 5:30. But whatever it is, she found enough variable foodstuffs to prepare and got something fixed for them, and it worked out fine.
What does this say about Minor White's personality?
Oh, he was easygoing. He sometimes was a little low on compliments, which a teacher should be. Whereas Ansel, you were never afraid to have him critique your work in front of the class, to hold it up like this. And he might suggest where you might have improved this a little bit, but this is a good idea, so don't give up, go back and try it again. You know, he was encouraging all the way along, where Minor was a little less in the encouragement part. But
I have the sense that he was self-taught, that whatever he thought he knew about photography had come from him and not from some other authority.
I think so. He was impressed with Weston, he was impressed with Stieglitz, and Paul Strand, some of the old stock names in photography at that time. He referred to them from time to time. But yeah, he was pretty well self-taught. He graduated from the University of Minnesota, or Michigan, one of those back then, and had come out to take this job in Portland. And I guess it was one of his first major jobs, and then he came to LeGrand under the WPA or PWA.
Did he ever say anything to you about what he thought LeGrand would be like and what he would do here?
I think it was just a stepping stone. I think he was just looking forward to where he could go on to the next bigger city.
He needed a check every now and then.
Yeah, you betcha. You betcha. Uh-huh.
You said there was an ad in the LeGrand Evening Observer for his classes. So
yeah,
I suppose there were other people besides you who took...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Morris
Geckler
for one, and a guy named Jim Chandler.
Morris Geckler, that's a famous name in LeGrand.
Well, yeah. He said something about Morris the Mice, and he should have said Morris the Mouse, but he said that he would make a good helper, but he talks so low that nobody can hear him, and he's absolutely right, because even as late as having been up here, before my dad passed away, we would go out to the senior center for a new meal once in a while, and Morris would be there, and you could walk up to him and talk to him across the table like this, and you could hardly hear him. You know, he just didn't have his volume control hooked up. But somewhere in here, I've got a letter that Minor wrote to my mother, saying something about Jim Chandler. I'm returning here. This is October of 41. I am returning some unused preserves and jellies that Mom had given him. They are much too good to let get out of the family. Also, I'm returning the bathtub. That was a big, deep hypo tray. It would hold about 2.5 gallons instead of the little shallow one. We called it a bathtub. And a light fixture, which was a safe light. And I left the printing box because Fred says he's built a better one. The print roller has to stay because the one Fred has is the government one, and the one here is on inventory in its place, if you can make sense out of that. Thank Jim for me for returning them. I hope to see Fred once in a while I'm in Portland. Perhaps I can get up Tacoma way. I hope so anyway. And then here is the one that I wrote to Jim Chandler commenting about this. So that was one of the other fellows that was in the class, and I guess there were several women, but I don't think they stayed more than 2 or 3 classes. But we had a class twice a week, I think.
What do you think these other people were hoping they would learn there?
maybe how to expose with the box camera.
Something pretty elementary, huh?
Oh,
definitely elementary.
And Miner wasn't too keen on talking about those things.
Well, no, not really. Here's a something else that came along.
Did he have people in the class critique one another's photos?
I don't remember that we ever did, because except for the second class, which I went to, which was on darkroom techniques, you never saw anything except what went to the drugstore to be finished. But the guy is commenting about that one, and he's not really impressed. Here is a letter that was sent out in April of 41 to Mother, announcing that the classes are going to resume, or he's going to have a lecture or something.
So he didn't like this photograph of the farm, although he thought it's okay, but it didn't receive any communication from it emotionally.
That's the critique, yes.
Yes.
And I.
And do you think anybody could make head or tail to that comment?
Not really. Here is a very Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So those are the instructors and what they were teaching. Someplace.
All men.
No,
all male teachers?
No, no. Prudham was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Isabel. Isabel. She was the girls' physical ed teacher here at the university, at the college when I went there. And she and Miner didn't date, as you would call it, but it was her influence that got him to join the Catholic Church. But she was down there once in a while working with Silk Screen, whatever they call that now. But it was kind of a fun time, and I can remember one time I was developing some infrared film. And in the dark room, they had a safe light that consisted of a square box with a hole in one side, and you had a cover that would go down. So you had the option of three different safe lights. One that was light yellow that you could use for prints, one that was a dark red that you could use for developing orthochromatic film, and then you had a blank side that would shut it off. And so I was developing some infrared film, and when I got through the fixer and could turn the light on, it was solid black. The safe light had been on, but the blank side had been down, and it had put out enough heat that it had fogged the infrared film. And so this was something that I was doing on my own, probably before I met Miner, because there was a reference to it in the article that I wrote to Peter Bunnell in Princeton about that. And he came back with the question, was Miner teaching or experimenting with infrared? And I said, no, that was entirely mine. He hadn't got into anything that exciting, as it were, by the time I was through his classes.
No, he's scheduled for two classes a week here.
Yeah.
I suppose they were a couple of hours each, typically.
Yeah, probably.
Well, 7:30 to 9:30 in the evening.
Yeah.
For beginning camera, and then 7 to 9 in the, I guess, also, yeah, in the evening.
Also a two-hour.
Or, yeah. What did he do with his days then? Just bum around and take pictures?
I don't know, because I was in school. Or, if it was a weekend, then he was off and we'd go off someplace together many times. So, there isn't a date on this, is there? Unfortunately.
No. It would have been probably 1940.
Oh, it was 1940. Yeah. Whether it was April or May, yeah, whatever. And so
I can't imagine he was paid much for teaching 2 2-hour classes a week.
Well, he was the director of the thing, so he was responsible for all the other teachers.
He was an administrator too.
Oh, that's the
I didn't know that.
Oh man, I'm telling you.
I don't imagine he had his heart in administration though.
No, not really. But one time at the school, and I mentioned this book of Pepsi-Cola, he also got a very select group to go down to Point Lobos to spend a weekend with Edward Weston. And so we're out on Point Lobos, and Edward is wandering around, and he would come, and you had a setup. He would get under your dark cloth and look at your ground glass and make some comments, compliment you, or make a suggestion, whatever. And so then that evening, we went to his home, Weston's home, on Wildcat Hill, and in a darkened room, he was showing us his prints on a lighted easel. At that time, you could buy any of them for $25. 8x10 contact prints. And I think that that he and Minor were going along on the same wavelength, because I don't remember that there was more than one picture of maybe 25 that he showed that night that I would have wanted to acquire to put on our wall. Because Edward's stuff was gloomy, depressing, experimental. He would take a pepper or a dozen peppers and spend days photographing peppers or seashells. Or he'd go down and do the sandstone concretions where the surf has washed in and out and worn these different forms into being, or the windblown cypress.
I imagine he liked texture.
I bet he did.
Didn't he also like to photograph nudes?
Weston?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, not only photograph them, he'd sleep with them. You know.
Well, why not?
Yeah.
Good way to understand texture.
Oh. Hey now. Anyway, I just recently acquired this book this last year.
Mm.
And if you kind of look through those, you can see the kind of gloomy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of the girls in our class, Ruth Marion Baruch. Okay, here's Edward Weston, and this is Phil Knight, and it was taken by my buddy Muffley. Mm-hmm. Muffley's the guy that said to me that White hasn't popped off many flashbulbs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, here's one of his nudes, 1945.
Uh-huh. But he and Edward were friends.
Minor and Edward?
No, Ansel. Oh, well, no, I'm sorry. Ansel Adams and Edward Weston were friends. But anyway, in the class was this Ruth Marion Baruch. Her father was a neurosurgeon in New York City, and she had wanted to come out and interview Edward Weston. And I'm pretty sure that there's another book that was written by his wife, Karis. She called it Through Another Lens. And she mentions this girl that was out there. And I'm sure that it was Ruth. And I guess she posed for him nude like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he slept with her that night. And the wife says, "How was it?" And he said, "Nah."
What do you mean, the photograph of the sleeping?
The sleeping.
Well, By that time, I'm sure he'd become a connoisseur.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
But see...
Well, I guess I see what you mean by gloominess, although that's not the first impression I get. That's certainly anything but gloomy.
True enough. But... Ansel had rather cryptic comments about Wesson's lousy technique as far as darkroom work and so forth. And his seeing may have been fine, but he didn't produce the print quality that you got from a course with Ansel.
This Gerald Robinson says that when he came to LeGrand in June 1940, he, in addition to teaching and supervising the Art Center, he apparently made his first attempts to teach photography. did it seem to you that he was an amateur at teaching, or he was just trying to figure out how to do it, how to conduct classes?
No, because it was my first experience with anything other than a manual training shop teacher that would be teaching a craft. And so he would try to get people to thinking, and here, let's go out and for next time bring back pictures that will indicate this. And that's when my mother brought in the one of the burnt light bulbs. And so it was in the